You know, people everywhere want a food supply that is fair, just, and sovereign, but most often end up with a food supply controlled by big government and big business. So today we pause to ask, can we farm our way to food sovereignty?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello. Hello out there. You are tuned into the 933rd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Cairo who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Aaron on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Hello.
Aaron, let me ask you this. Can we farm our way to food sovereignty?
I think so.
You think so? Good enough. Also here with us in the studio, we have, from Montana, nephew Matthew Richardson. Matthew, welcome aboard.
Yes, thank you.
So what do you think? Can we farm our way to food sovereignty?
I hope so.
You hope so? Good enough. Also with us, Vanessa Richardson. Vanessa, welcome.
Hello.
Now, do you think we can farm our way to food sovereignty?
I think we can.
Okay, so we are filled with optimism today, folks. You know, in the 1920s, the British Raj held a monopoly on all the salt in India. And the Raj forced the Indians to pay a tax for this essential element. In 1930, Mahatma Gandhi led a 240-mile march from his ashram in the interior of India to the seacoast village of Dandi to make salt in direct contravention to British authority. When Gandhi made his salt at Dandi, he was joined in the making of salt by millions of others throughout India, thus precipitating a movement that resulted in the independence of the Indian people from British rule. Though there are no longer any laws that grant monopoly control over essential foods, there is economic consolidation and bureaucratic rules and regulations that, in effect, kind of do the same thing. Thus, throughout the world today, people still must rely on others granting them access to essential foods. Like Indians making salt with Gandhi, many throughout the world are striving to farm their way to food sovereignty. Though their efforts take them in many different directions, they all seem to be searching for the energy that will power up their farms and keep them powered up. Their efforts lead us to ask today, why does food production and processing tend to become consolidated in the hands of the few instead of the hands of the many? Why do people resist centralized food systems and seek food sovereignty? And is profit the means or the obstacle to food sovereignty? Well, here today to help us answer, we have a couple of gals that should know, because they've been writing all about it in a book called Harvesting Justice. We have, let's see, we'll start with Beverly Bell. Beverly, welcome to the Food Chain.
Michael, I'm delighted to be with you and your friends in the studio.
Well, we're happy to have you aboard. Let's see a little bit about Beverly. Beverly Bell, you're a coordinator with Other Worlds. What's Other Worlds?
Other Worlds is a small collaborative of women who are looking for positive alternatives, economic, social, and gender alternatives, and finding that, in fact, there are solutions for many of the greatest problems in the world. People just don't know about it, and so we try and spread that news.
Good enough. That's what we're here today. Beverly, we always ask a very embarrassing question of our guests, which is, who pays the way? And, of course, we ask that to kind of get an idea of where people are coming from. So when people say, yeah, I'm getting a grant from the Monsanto Corporation, we kind of know what they're talking about. So who pays your way?
Other Worlds gets all of its funding, which is not very much. We're lean and mean, but we get it all through very wonderful, committed individuals who believe in what we do and a few progressive foundations. No corporate money, and Monsanto, they wouldn't touch us with the 10-foot pole, and we wouldn't touch them with the 20-foot one.
Okay, fair enough. Also with us today, your co-author of Harvesting Justice, Tori Field. From the other side of the country, right, Tori?
That's right. I'm out in Western Massachusetts.
Western Massachusetts. Fair enough. Thank you for having us aboard. You're the research coordinator for Other Worlds, so you work with Beverly, and you're the co-author of Harvesting Justice. You're also a farmer at the Next Barn Over Farm.
That's right, yep. We have a CSA farm out here in Hadley, Massachusetts. It's a 30-acre mixed vegetable CSA.
And how did you come up with the name Next Barn Over Farm?
Oh, it's a long and not incredibly interesting story, but we're sort of the next generation of the farm where we learned to farm, which was right down the road. And when they moved on, we adopted that name.
Okay, good enough. Mm-hmm. And probably symbolic of what we're talking about today. Harvesting, let's start with some terms so that we can get people grounded in where we're going today. Harvesting justice, what exactly do you mean by justice? We'll start with you, Beverly.
Well, justice for us means that the people who grow the food get income for it, and that is small farmers who are being put out of business at a rapid clip around the world thanks to agribusiness, which is displacing them. It means land for people who are being pushed off those farms. It means that everyone has access to good and quality food, whether they are rich or poor. It means that trade rules are fair so that they don't destroy small farmer production, especially in small countries. There are so many answers to your question, which I've never been asked before, and it's a great question. And we are so excited to see movement all around the world of organized people creating those solutions.
Good enough. There it is. There's your definition for justice, or at least a partial definition. Enough to get us going down the road. Tori, what is food sovereignty?
Well, food sovereignty is a term that's maybe a little bit still quite new in this country, but has been being used in other parts of the world for a while now. And food sovereignty is really a broad concept and set of principles. And it takes into, at its root, food sovereignty means communities and people having control and having the power to make decisions about their food systems, not corporations.
Mm-hmm. Would a good synonym be independence, like food independence, like we're independent of anybody, we can grow our own food? Would that be kind of
maybe independence and interdependence both happening at the same time. I think food sovereignty has a set of principles that recognize all the different things that go into creating food, the ways that we produce and distribute food. And so it's not just about making sure that everyone has enough to eat. It's also, you know, it's both about that, but also about all the ways in which how we farm affects the land. It's about the people who grow the food and how their work is valued. It's about international trade agreements and the effects they have on farming around the world. So it takes into account all these different pieces.
And both of you have been working in this area of food justice and food sovereignty for a number of years and around the world, correct, Beverly?
Yes, I've actually been working with peasant movements and small farmer movements for about three decades in Africa and the U.S. and Latin America and the Caribbean.
What's your favorite place?
My favorite place. In terms of this, I would have to say Brazil, where people have organized and have done extraordinary things. For example, and hopefully we can talk about this, in one city they have decided to commit themselves to zero hunger. And in the city called Belo Horizonte of 2.5 million people, they have gotten rid of hunger. Now, if that doesn't tell us that there's an answer to every problem in the world, I don't know what does.
Fair enough. And Tori, what about you? You've been traipsing around too.
Well, a little bit here and there, although I've mostly been based in Hadley now for about 20 years. I've done a little bit of traveling here and there.
And but you have been working out in the field for quite a while in this regard. We're going to take a quick break. But that's where we're headed today. We're going to be harvesting justice. And the questions we're going to be working with today, why does food production and processing tend to become consolidated in the hands of a few instead of the many? Why do people resist centralized food systems and seek food sovereignty? And is profit the means or the obstacle to food sovereignty? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson, your host, and you are invited to participate. You pick up your phone today and dial us at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Beverly Bell and Tori Field, who are co-authors of Harvesting Justice. And by golly, they're out to change the world. Can they? Can we farm our way to food independence? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain. We will be right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, what do you think out there? Can we farm our way to food independence, to food sovereignty? Can we develop a just food system? And the question I have is, why does food production and processing tend to become consolidated in the hands of a few instead of the many? You know, we don't no longer have this tax monopolies like the British Raj had in India, but we do have economic consolidation that puts the means of production in the hands of relatively few. And we also have bureaucratic rules and regulations that are designed to protect us, but they also prohibit us from taking care of ourselves. To see what I mean, try milking your cow and selling the milk and cheese to neighbors. Or try turning Betsy the cow into hamburgers and selling those hamburgers at a Little League game. Or try growing some spinach and packaging up that spinach for sale to the school across town. You'll find yourself smothered in rules and regulations that really are designed to protect us, but also prohibit us. So there are millions of these rules and regulations. So how does the power become consolidated into the hands of a few? Beverly Bell, Tori Field, you folks have been looking at this for a long time. Why is it that it all becomes consolidated like that into the hands of a few?
Well, I can take that. This is Beverly.
Okay, Beverly.
We can look at our laws and the way that the cozy relationship between lobbyists in Washington and congresspeople and the proclivities of this and former administrations have been consistently shifting support and subsidies to multinational corporations, if not banks. I mean, we've seen it all over. What has happened, Michael, with subsidies is very, very critical to everything here. Subsidies were started many decades ago as a way to protect small farmers in years where there were poor harvests. It was, you could think of it as a price floor. They were guaranteed a certain income from tax dollars, but over the years, those subsidies have been taken away primarily from small farmers and shifted over to Monsanto, to Cargill, to Archer Daniels Midland, etc., the people who distribute the food and the people who, in some cases, are growing it in huge quantity, often on land that has been expropriated from small farmers. And then there's one other way, besides the failure of the subsidy system to be just, in other words, another way that the consolidation has happened, and that is through trade laws. So I know this sounds very boring, and people's eyes might glaze when they hear trade
laws. Wake up out there. We're talking trade laws.
But they're really critical because what has happened is that the U.S. government and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have pushed, and other powerful countries, have pushed small countries to drop their tariffs. In other words, have done away with protections for their farmers, while, of course, as I just explained, in the U.S., there are huge protections for big farmers here. And so the small farmers have gone out of business in the global south as well. And as that has happened, the dumping and the export of these crops from the U.S., again, that are subsidized by your and my tax dollars, are able to flood markets and increasingly shift the control of food and who gets to sell it and how into the hands of a very, very few businesses.
Well, in considering this topic, I was happened upon this article in the Wall Street Journal. It kind of stopped me in my tracks. The title of the piece was U.S. Rice Farmers Cash In on Venezuelan Socialism. And I thought, no, how in the heck does that happen? And in reading, this is a little snitch from the piece, and it says, and I quote, Chavez said, we are against capitalists and we are against big oligarchs, says Moises Naim of the Washington's Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. But, and I continue the quote, he left the country more beholden to foreigners and foreign companies than ever before. It seems like no matter how hard we try to disassemble this consolidation and this concentration of power, it just keeps growing regardless. And I've come to think that there might be a natural affinity between big government and big business that just encourages the consolidation. Tori, what do you think?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what we're seeing. And just going back to the subsidy piece, that's exactly what's happening. You know, government, our government is making and holding up laws that essentially are promoting the growth and the profit of large corporations. There's this misconception with agricultural subsidies that they are going to, you know, these tax dollars are going to large-scale farmers and making these farmers rich. And though that may happen every now and then, what's really happening is it's allowing these farmers to sell their crops for dirt cheap without going completely out of business. And who's actually profiting from that are the corporations that are buying the crops, turning them into something else, and then selling those. So it's really the corporations that are winning. And the same thing, you know, that's happening in the scenario, for example, around rice that you're bringing up. You know, agribusiness is buying rice for incredibly cheap in this country, in many cases, most cases, for actually less money than it costs to grow the rice in the first place. And they're taking it, you know, either selling it here in the U.S. or taking it overseas and selling it overseas for such a low price that farmers who are growing rice down the road can't even begin to compete with it. So they're pushing, you know, farmers all around the world out of their livelihoods.
Beverly, this sounds like a good example or a good explanation, at least, of what is happening to the corn farmers of Mexico.
That's right. Mexico has it's a country with the tagline of the land of maize, and yet, ironically, that corn is that people eat in their tortillas every day. Most families in Mexico is no longer even grown there. Most of it comes from the U.S. And you know, Michael, what you asked about and what Tori was talking about points out a really critical element of food sovereignty, and that is it's not just about how we grow or even who distributes the food. It's about reclaiming democracy. And if you look at small farmer movements and indigenous landed people and landless movements and others who are part of this great, great burst of energy around the world, a huge element in what they are doing is saying to their government, no more, stop this relationship between you and the big corporations that is putting us out of business. And we have seen some fantastic examples of success of where people have been able to push back on their government and revitalize democracy. And I would just like to add that for change to happen, it's something that we're going to need to work on more consistently and with more strength right here at home.
Well, it seems like what you're saying is that the analogy of Gandhi and the Great Salt March to Dandi is happening here and there and everywhere. And yet we have governments that by nature want to consolidate control over their people. And we have business that wants to eliminate competition. And so we have this natural affinity between big government and big business that would seem to oppose the efforts to have any salt marches in agriculture, as it were. What makes you so optimistic that we can do this?
Oh, because we're seeing it happen. You can just point to example after example. For example, to go back to Brazil, people pushed enough that they changed the 1988 National Constitution to guarantee land reform of land over a certain size if that land was not being used for social benefit. And now there are hundreds of millions of families who have or hundreds of thousands anyway, but it's way, way up there, who have reclaimed land and have now gone back to the land and are able to support their families with dignity by growing. These are people who were pushed off by multinationals and now are back on the land. We see, I love this example, some years back in Cancun, Mexico, the World Trade Organization was meeting with a focus on inserting the rules of the WTO much more deeply around food and agriculture. And organized Mexican small farmers, campesinos, who have no money and no power, came together with allies in Cancun and demonstrated and shut down the whole agricultural process.
Okay, Beverly, you have to take a quick break, but that sounds positive. I guess when we come back, why do people resist centralized food systems and seek food sovereignty? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Do stay tuned. Well, I wonder, why not content ourselves with food from the boxes of industry? It's so easy to walk into that big box store and buy food in boxes. It's cheap. Walk out and there we are and we're all happy. And then in that regard, Vanessa from Montana has a question that maybe Beverly and Tori can answer. Vanessa, right up into the microphone there.
All right, so we have been hearing about these food producers or whatnot. Who is Monsanto's?
Yeah. Who is Monsanto? Tori, you want to try that?
Sure. Monsanto is a very large corporation that sells both seeds and chemicals, agricultural chemicals, pesticides, and fertilizers. They're one of the biggest they own a large percentage of the world's seeds. They're one of the biggest corporations that sells seeds and pesticides. And they're also the largest corporation involved in working on creating GMO, genetically modified organisms, in actually creating new genetically modified seeds and crops.
And in that regard, I see where they're getting a new Superstax corn approved in Europe. Superstax means that there are six different kinds of genes that have been infused into this corn that allow it to be drenched in two kinds of herbicides without dying. And it is infused with four kinds of pesticides that it will kill four different kinds of bugs. So this technology is really great for farmers because farmers can grow crops and not have to worry about corn borers or whatnot. But what of the people who eat the corn? Vanessa's a registered nurse. Vanessa?
Yeah.
What do you think?
With people getting these chemicals, what are the diseases that are going to come out of that? What are we going to see in people's health down the road?
Well, there's certainly a lot of debate about what the health effects of GMOs are, but there's also a lot of proof about what the effect of increased pesticide use is, and how that relates to our health. I don't think GMOs, I don't think it's a full picture to say that GMOs are good for farmers and bad for consumers. I think, in Mexico, for example, GMO seeds, GMO corn, which, corn pollen spreads via the wind, and genetically modified corn seeds are basically spreading throughout the country, and making it so that farmers can't save the seeds that they have had for generation after generation. So
that was always an interesting thing for me. Beverly, a quick question to you. When a genetically engineered corn plant pollinates a native race of corn in some village in Mexico, and who owns the consequent corn? I mean,
well, this is what's so interesting and so controversial, and what farmers are organizing so ferociously around, is that Monsanto says that if corn that has their strain of GMO seed in it comes up, that you and if you didn't buy that corn and those seeds from them, that you are in violation of the law. And Monsanto has sued hundreds of farmers, including very, very small farmers, some of them successfully, farmers who never even planted those seeds, did not want GMO corn, but their fields were either polluted by the corn from, a few fields over, or their crop from last year, where they may have bought that corn or something else, sprouted, they're called volunteers, sprouted again this year, and they are ruled at, taken to court for contract violation. And it really just shows how the power that has been put into the hands of these giants has just gone way too far.
So what's wrong with not contenting ourselves with being fed by the power of those giants?
Well, I'll jump in here. This is Tori.
All right.
I think, as you mentioned before, the sort of one of the goals of industrial scale corporate produced food was to create a lot of food for very cheap. And, in some cases that has happened. When you go to the store, you're able to buy a loaf of bread for, a very low amount of money. And I think the thing that people are realizing is that actually there are all these hidden costs associated with that. That cost we're paying at the grocery store is just one tiny drop in the bucket of the cost of what's actually being used to produce that. So, and the costs are huge and real. They're, our planet is being poisoned. We have incredible environmental costs based on the techniques that are used in industrial-scale farming. There are tremendous costs to small farmers who are going out of business and who have been going out of business at a remarkable rate. There are incredible costs to farm workers and food workers who are, not making enough money and whose rights are not being respected in the system, and so on and so on. There are costs to our health, eating this industrial produced food that is nutritionally deficient. And so actually it's not that cheap. This food is not that cheap. It's incredibly expensive when you look at the larger picture of it, and people are realizing that and realizing that we need to quickly create something different.
Beverly, is that part of the equation here in what you folks are seeking to do is to raise our consciousness with respect to the true costs of cheap food?
Absolutely. And that is one reason, I think, why farmers markets and CSAs, community supportive agriculture, has been burgeoning around the U.S. as people realize that they don't want to support this system. They don't want to be part of that. We also see small farmers around the world working very hard to save their seeds so that they don't have to purchase from those giant corporations. And Tori can talk about how she tried to actually find seed in her area of Western Mass that wasn't owned by Monsanto, and it was very hard because they are sneaky and they keep changing the names of the seeds and they don't put their name on there anywhere. But all over we see people saying, you know, we don't want our food, that which is the most basic element of our survival along with water and air, we don't want it perverted to not be healthy and to exploit other people in the process. And that's a big part of what food sovereignty is about.
So got a call from an attorney in a ag town, big ag town, and he said, Michael, did you get the letter? And I said, no, what letter are you talking about? He said, the letter from XXX, which is a big grower shipper. And I said, nope, didn't see it. What does it say? And he said, it says that if local, and this was directed to farmers and producers, and it said, if local food is taking a bite out of your profit, join us in Washington, D.C. Now, what does that mean? I think I know what it means, and I think you know what it means, too. So, that's the subject on the table today. So, when we get back, I'd like to ask Beverly and Tori, is profit the means or the obstacle to food sovereignty? Anxious to hear what you have to say, too. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, folks, if we want food sovereignty, we're going to have to go out and get it somehow. But what on earth are we going to use to power up our farms and keep them powered up so that we can produce the food that we need and the food that we want? In direct contravention to the desires of the British Raj, who doesn't want us to have our independence, I don't think. Now, let me ask you, Beverly and Tori, do you think government wants us to be independent?
Well, I could take that.
Okay.
I think it goes back to what you said, Michael, that there is this often a very close relationship between big business and big government. And yet it hasn't always been that way. And I've heard people say, oh, my gosh, it's too late. The corporations have too much power. They will never go back. Well, that's what they said about slavery. That's what they said about apartheid. That's what they said about segregation in the deep south of the U.S.
That's what they said about salt in India, too, right?
Precisely. This book, Harvesting Justice, which, by the way, is a nonprofit book and a sliding scale, and anyone who can't pay for it, we're so happy to give one because we created it to inspire people. It contains so many examples of ways that people actually are making change and are having victories in the small and in the large around the world. And we have seen not just beating down the corporate power, but also people forcing governments to change laws that protect landless people, that protect consumers, that protect small farmers.
And hopefully do it in a way that Hugo Chavez didn't do, so that the country ends up dependent on huge rice farmers in America or something like that. You know, I have a question for both of you, and that is profit the means or the obstacle to food sovereignty? I was watching a documentary on Cuban urban agriculture, which I have been a fan on ever since the Soviet Union dumped its sponsorship of Cuba. Cuba really was in a tough strait because it had no food. It had no food infrastructure. So what Cuba had to do was develop urban or metropolitan agriculture to survive. And now that metropolitan agriculture is a huge part of the Cuban food chain. So I was watching a documentary on these urban farms, and I saw and heard something that really struck me as being strange, and that is the assertion that the organic farmers of Cuba were selling food for less than the industrial foods were costing, and they were proud of that. And I thought, wait a minute here. This is entirely back-ass words. That food should be prized and should be worth much more, and people should be willing to pay it and thus make those peasant farmers well-to-do. They should be the rock stars of our society instead of the peasants of our society. I think money should come from the bottom up instead of the top down. Am I wrong?
Well, I would just say that everyone should be able to afford organic food. And that's one of the things in this country that the food movement is looking at. You know, organic local food has a reputation or has become in some ways elite in that, you know, it is more expensive to go to the farmer's market and buy good quality food. And that's because we are operating in this system that's providing industrial scale food at a price that is not true. It's
okay.
You know, not the true cost.
So the real issue here then is that the organic food is not more expensive. In real terms, it's probably much less expensive to buy that organic food than it is to buy the cheap industrial food with very little nutrition in it.
Well, it's true that the cost to the planet and to our health are much less. And it's also true that, you know, we need to address other issues and other problems, poverty and racism, that affect whether or not people can afford this food. So, you know, it's all connected. We, you know, we need to address housing, we need to address healthcare, so that everyone has the capacity to access this food. And there are some amazing organizations and communities that are creating, you know, really creative responses to figuring out how to make this food accessible to everyone.
Well, how do we address all of those other issues without having a real strong economic food chain? I just think that if those peasant farmers were making all the money instead of the government bureaucrats, then it would be much easier to address the poverty of their neighborhoods.
Well, certainly, and if farmers were being you know, valued and paid in the way that they should be, then they would also be able to produce food for and sell it,
And provide jobs
to more people. Absolutely,
and provide jobs. You know, mm-hmm. and with that kind of money flowing through the local economy, there would be money to patronize the butchers and the bakers and the candlestick makers. but without an economic foundation, without a strong local economy, then I don't understand how you can possibly address all of the other issues that make it hard for people to buy food. That's just Michael Olson blowing off steam. What do you think, Beverly?
Oh, I think that you're right in terms of how complicated and challenging it is. But what is so great is how organized communities, even absent having that strong economic base that you're talking about, have been able to do remarkable things. For example,
hold that example, because you're going to give it to me when we get back. Pick out your best example and bring us some hope. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for the hour, with Beverly Bell and Tori Fields, co-author of Harvesting Justice. Do stay tuned. Well, how can we farm our way to independence? What is the mechanism? With us, Beverly Bell, co-author of Harvesting Justice, Tori Field, co-author of Harvesting Justice. Before you give us an example, people want to know. They're calling up and saying, what is the book? How do we get the book? And what are the women's organizations? Beverly?
Sure, great. We would love for people to order it. Again, we're not making a profit, and it can be available very cheap. Or
you should make a profit. You should get rich writing this book.
Yes, we're millionaires by now. No, we work with the poorest people in the world. Okay, so people can go to their website and go to harvesting-justice.org. That's harvesting-justice.org, and order one. And our organization is called Other World, and we are working with people all over the globe who are in search of solutions to some of the greatest problems of the day and are, in fact, creating them. So our aim with this book, as with our organization, is to empower people to know that you don't have to be a brilliant policy analyst in Washington. You don't have to get on a bus and go to a demonstration. You can make change wherever you are if you put yourself together with others, and it's happening.
Amen. Now, so give us an example of how it's happening.
Okay. So Tori, my dear colleague and farmer and co-author, was giving us some information on how local food can be accessed, healthy and organic food. But there has been a challenge because, as we know, organic food is very expensive, and so it has not reached everybody. So there is one strand of this work that's called food justice. And what that means is that food needs to be accessible to everybody, regardless of where you live. That is, even if you live in a so-called food desert where there are not grocery stores in your neighborhood.
Like downtown Oakland.
Downtown Oakland, exactly. And also regardless of what your income level is. So, for instance, there is a wonderful organization, a nonprofit, in New York called Just Food. And they have creatively come up with 8 ways that low-income people can access farmers markets and community-supported agriculture, which can be prohibitively expensive.
1 minute left.
Pardon?
1 minute left. So give us the ways. How do we get in touch with this food?
Exactly. Yes, is for example what's called Share a Share, and in it, high-income neighborhoods who have CSAs have agreed to pay more for their food so as to subsidize the food at the other end of people. And it's just an example that we can make change, and we don't have to wait till we've conquered the big beast.
And you have a lot of these different ways in harvesting justice. So if people really want to give it a thought, pick up a copy of Harvesting Justice and make these gals rich by reading their book. That's what my goal is. Folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio Program. With us today, Beverly Bell, co-author of Harvesting Justice. Tori Field, also a co-author of Harvesting Justice. And you. You can participate in this program by logging on the forums at metrofarm.com, making your case. I want to thank Beverly and Tori for joining us. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. We'll see you next week for more What's Eating What Radio. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.